Writing of a structure at scale is hard. It's messy, it's complicated, and it has a tendency to go sideways in the middle of the night. Rather than talk about the idealized versions of things, we're going to talk about the rough edges. We're going to talk about what it's really like running infrastructure at scale. Welcome to the Real World DevOps Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Julian, editor and analyst for Monitoring Weekly and author of O'Reilly's Practical Monitoring. This episode is sponsored by the lovely folks at Influx Data. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably also interested in better monitoring tools, and that's where Influx comes in. Personally, I'm a huge fan of their products, and I often recommend them to my own clients. You're probably familiar with their time series database, InfluxDB, but you may not be as familiar with their other tools. Telegraph for metrics collection from systems, Chronograph for visualization, and Capacitor for real-time streaming. All of this is available as open source, and they also have a hosted commercial version, too. You can check all of this out at influxdata.com.
Hi, folks. I'm here with Yan Choi, an independent consultant who helps companies adopt serverless technologies. Welcome to the show, Yan.
Hi, Mike. It's good to be here.
So tell me, what do you do? You're an independent consultant helping companies with serverless. What does that mean?
So I actually started using serverless quite a few years back. Pretty much as soon as AWS announced it, I started playing around with it. And the last couple of years, I've done quite a lot of work building serverless applications in production. And I've also been really active in just writing about things I've learned along the way. So as part of that, a lot of people have been asking me questions because they saw my blog and talk about some problems that they've been struggling with and asked me, hey, can you come and help me with this? I've got some questions. So as part of doing that, I like to help people, first of all. Just as part of doing that, it's something that's become happening more and more often. So in the last couple of months, I've started to work as an independent consultant, helping companies who are looking at adopting serverless or maybe moving to serverless or moving into serverless for a new project, and they want to have some guidance in terms of things they should be thinking about, and have some architectural reviews on a regular basis. So for things like that, I've been helping with a number of companies, both in terms of workshops but also regular architectural reviews. And at the same time, I also work part-time at a company called The Zone, which is a sports streaming platform, and we also use serverless and containers very heavily there as well.
Okay, so why don't we back up several steps? What the hell is serverless? Just to make sure that we're all talking about the same thing, what are we talking about?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I guess a lot of people have been asking the same question as well, because nowadays you see pretty much everyone is throwing the serverless label at their product and services.
Right.
And going by popular definition out there based on what I see in the talks and blog posts, I guess, in terms of my social my social media circle, serverless, by the most popular definition, serverless is pretty much any technology where you don't pay for it when you're not using it, because paying for uptime is a very serverful way of thinking and planning. And two is you don't have to worry about managing and patching servers, because installing daemons or agents or any form of auxiliary or support software on it is, again, something that's tied to having servers that you have to manage. And three, you don't have to worry about scaling and provisioning, because the system will just scale the number of underlying servers on demand. And by these definitions, I think a lot of the sort of traditional backend service things out there, like AWS S3 or Google BigQuery, they will also qualify as a serverless as well.
Okay, so Lambda is a good example of serverless, but there's also this thing of a function as a service, and they seem to be used interchangeably sometimes. What's going on there?
So to me, function as a service describes a change in terms of how we structure our applications and changing the unit of deployment and scaling to the function level that makes up the application. A lot of the function as a service solutions like Azure Functions or Lambda, as you mentioned, they will also qualify as serverless based on a definition we just talked about. And there are generally, I find this, there are a lot of overlap between the two concepts or paradigms between functions as service and the serverless. But I think there are some important subtleties in how they differ, because you also have functions as service solutions like Kubeless or Knative that gives you the function oriented programming model and the reactive and event-driven model for building applications, but then runs on your own Kubernetes cluster. So if you have to manage and run your own Kubernetes cluster, then you do have to worry about scaling, and you do have to worry about patching servers, and you do have to worry about paying for uptime for those servers, even when no one is running stuff on them. So the line is blurred when you consider Kubernetes as service things like Amazon's EKS or Google GKE, where they offer Kubernetes as a service, or Amazon's Fargate, which lets you run containers on Amazon's fleet of machines, so you don't have to worry about provisioning and managing and scaling servers yourself. At the end of the day, I think being serverless is, or having the right labels associated with your product, is not important. It's all about building and it's all about delivering on business needs quickly, but having a well understood definition on those different ideas that we have really helps us in terms of understanding the implicit assumptions we make when we talk about something. So now that everyone is talking about calling their services or products serverless, is really not helping anyone, because if everything is serverless, then nothing is serverless. And I really can't tell what sort of assumptions I can make when I think about your product.
Right. This is the problem with the buzzwords, is the more you have of them, the less it actually means, and the more confused I am about what you do. So because I love talking about where things fall apart, like serverless, it's a cool idea. I think it works really well. And yet I've seen so many companies get so enamored with it that they spend 6 months trying to build their application on serverless, or like in that model. And then a month later they go under. It's like, you know, I can't help but make that the tie between the two of, you spend all your time trying to innovate on this, and at the end of the day, you didn't have any time to innovate on, you know, the product. So like, that's an interesting failure model. But I'm sure there's others here where people are adopting serverless in the same way when we first started adopting containers. Like, hey, I just deployed a container and like works on my machine. Have fun. So when is serverless not a good idea? Like, what are the pitfalls we're running into? What are people not thinking about?
Yeah, I think there's one of the problems we see all the time is, as you mentioned, when something's a hype. When a lot of the adoptions happen because there's a lot of hype behind the technology, and there's a lack of understanding of the business requirements you really have and the technical constraints that you have, and you go straight into it. I think this happens all the time, and that's why we have the whole hype cycle to go with it. I think when you're a newcomer to a new paradigm, and it's easy to become infatuated by what this paradigm can do, and when you see the whole world as a hammer, you start looking for nails everywhere. And this happened. This happened when we discovered NoSQL. I mean, all of a sudden, everything has to be done with NoSQL. You know, MongoDB and Redis was used everywhere to solve every possible database problem, often again with disastrous results, because again, people are not thinking about the constraints and the business needs they actually have, and focus too much on the tech. If anything, I think with serverless, we have this great opportunity to think more about how do we deliver business value quickly rather than thinking about the technology itself. But as engineers, as technology people ourselves, you can see how easy it is to fall into that trap. And I think there's a couple of use cases where serverless is just not a very good fit in general right now. One of them is when you require consistent and very high performance. So quite a lot has been made about the cold start, which is something that is relatively new to serverless, to a lot of people using serverless. But again, it's not something that's new entirely. For a very long time, we've had to deal with long garbage collection pauses or server being overloaded because load is not evenly distributed. But with serverless, that becomes something that's systematic, because every time a new container spawns to run your function, you get this spike in latency. For some applications, that is not acceptable because maybe you're building a real-time game, for example, where latency have to be consistent and have to be very, very fast. You're talking about, say, a multiplayer game needing a 99th percentile latency to be below 100 milliseconds. That's not something that you can guarantee with Lambda or any serverless platform today.
I worked with a company a while back that was building a real-time engine, and that was a hell of a problem. So we were building everything on bare metal and VMware, and then had just this really nice orchestration layer running on top of Puppet. And this is a hell of a problem because as load comes up, we're automatically scaling the stuff out. Except as we're adding the new nodes, latency is spiking because we're trying to move traffic over to something that's not ready for it.
Yes, and with serverless, you don't have this luxury of, say, let the server warm up first, and then you give it some time before you actually put it into active use. It literally gets spawned on the first request that you don't have a spare server running around to handle. So you always have cold start, so you can't just say, okay, I'm going to give the server 5 minutes to get warmed up first. Maybe it's a JVM that takes a bit of warm-up time so that you configure your load balancer and the rest of the system to take into account the time it needs to warm up before you put into active service. With serverless, you can't do that. So where you do need those consistent high-performance, serverless is really a bad fit right now. I think you just touched on something else there as well, the fact that you need to have a persistent connection to a server, to some kind of logical notion of a server. That's, again, something that serverless is not a good fit for. If you want, say, a persistent WebSocket connection in order to do, say, real-time push notifications to connected devices or to implement subscription features in the GraphQL, for example, in those cases, you're also constrained by the fact that one invocation for a function can run for only a certain amount of time. I think that's a good constraint. It tells you that there are certain use cases that are really good for function as a service, but there are whole other cases that you just shouldn't even think about doing it. There are other ways you can sort of get around it, but by the time you do all of that, you really have to kind of ask yourself, am I doing the right thing here?
Right.
And I think another interesting case is that, and this is again something that I find often made out of proportion, is in terms of the cost. Sure, Lambda is cheap and it's because you don't pay for it when it's not running, but when you have even a medium amount of load, you might find that you might pay more for API Gateway and Lambda compared to if you just run a web server yourself. Mm-hmm. Now, that's true, but one of the things that you don't think about, and at least most people don't think about enough, is the personnel cost. The amount of skill set you need to run your own cluster, to be able to look after your Kubernetes cluster, to do all these other things associated with having a server, that often is automatically more expensive than whatever premium you pay for AWS to run in your functions. However, if you're talking about a system that has got, I don't know, maybe tens of thousands of requests per second consistently all the way throughout the day, then those premiums on individual invocations can start to stack up really, really quickly. And I had a chat with some of the guys at Netflix a while back, and they mentioned that they did a quick calculation that if everything on Netflix runs on Lambda today, it would cost them something like 8 times more. And for if they're running at Netflix scale, that is a lot of money, way more than the amount of money you pay to hire the best team in the world to look after your infrastructure. So if you're at that level of scale and the cost is start to rack up, then maybe it's also time to think about maybe moving your load into a more traditional containerized or VM-based setup where you can get a lot more out of your server and do a lot more of the performance optimization there than to run them in Lambda. And I think the final use case where Lambda is probably not that good a fit, or serverless is not that good a fit today, is that even though you get a good baseline of redundancy built in, so you get multi-AZ out of the box, and you can also build multi-region active APIs relatively easily, but because we are relying the platform to do a lot more, and the platform itself is essentially a black box to us, there are also cases where some of the built-in redundancy might not be enough. For example, if I'm doing real-time event stream processing events in real-time with Kinesis and Lambda, the state of the polar is a black box, is something that I can't access. So if I want to build a multi-region setup, whereby if one region starts to fail, I can move the stream processing to a different region and turn it on. So I have active passive setup, then I need to access the internal state for the polar, which is not something that I can do, or I have to build a whole lot of infrastructure around it to be able to simulate that. And again, by the time I invest all the effort to do all of that, maybe I should just start with something else to begin with. Again, those are some of the constraints that I tend to think about when I decide whether or not Lambda or serverless is a good fit for the problem that I'm trying to solve. As much as I love serverless, again, I don't think it's about the technology. It's about finding ways that can deliver the business needs you have. So whatever you choose, you have to meet the business needs first and foremost, and then anything that can let you move faster, you know, you should go with that.
So all this kind of reminds me of an image that floated around Twitter a while back that people dubbed the Docker cliff. And the idea was that you had Docker as like at the very bottom of dev and prod, but to get something from dev, like get when I'm developing Docker on my laptop, to actually put it in production takes way more than just a container. Like, how do you do the orchestration? How do you do the scheduling? How are you managing network? What are you doing about deployment, monitoring, supervision, security, and just all this other stuff on top of it that people weren't really thinking about? And so for developers, Docker was fantastic. Like, oh, hey, everything is great. It's really nice, self-contained, deployable thing, except it's not really that deployable. And I'm kind of seeing that serverless is much the same way. We threw out a bunch of Lambda functions, like, this is great. And then the immediately next question is, how do I know they're working? Like, how do I know when they're not working? What's going on with them? CloudWatch logs is absolutely awful. So trying to understand what it's doing through there is just super painful. And the deployment model is kind of janky right now. Like, how I've been deploying them is just a shell script wrapped around the AWS CLI. I'm sure there's better ways to do it. So are there other stuff like this? Like, are there other things that we're not really thinking about? And what do we do about those?
Yeah, absolutely. The funny thing is that a lot of the problems that you talk about are things I hear from other clients or from the people from the community all the time. In terms of how do I do deployment and how do I do basic observability stuff. And the thing is that there are really solutions out there to various different degrees. And I think you find that with a lot, as the case with a lot of the AWS services, that they cover the basic user needs, CloudWatch logs being a perfect example for that, but it does it very crudely. So, but
right. It's like an MVP of a logging system.
Yes.
Sorry, CloudWatch team. It's true.
And the same goes to, I guess, CloudWatch itself as well. But the good thing is that at least you don't have to worry about having to install those agents and whatever to ship your logs to CloudWatch logs. So CloudWatch logs becomes a good staging place for your logs and gather them. And then from there, you can actually ship them to somewhere else. Maybe an LSTAG or maybe one of the managed services like Loggly or Splunk or something else. So the paradigm for doing that is actually pretty straightforward. I've got two blog posts, which I guess we can link to in the
yeah, we'll throw those in the show notes.
In the show notes. One other thing which I think is quite important is security. Again, as developers, we are just not used to thinking about security, and I see a lot of organizations try to tackle this security problem with this hammer called a VPC, as if having a network security is going to solve all of your problems. And most of VPCs, in fact, every single VPC I've seen in production, none of them do egress filtering, so that if anyone is able to compromise your network security, then you find yourself in this fully trusted environment where services talk to each other with no authentication, because you just assume, okay, it's trusted because you're inside a VPC now. But then we've seen several times how easy it is to compromise the whole ecosystem by attacking the dependencies everyone have. NPM dependencies, I think it was last year when a researcher managed to compromise something like 14% of all NPM packages, which accounts for something like a quarter of the monthly downloads on NPM, including...
Well, that's going to make me sleep well.
So imagine if someone just compromised one of your dependencies and put a few lines of code there to scan your environment variables and then send it to their own backend to harvest all these different AWS credentials and see whether or not you can do some funky stuff or do Bitcoin mining with them. That is not something that you can really protect by putting a VPC in front of things. And yet we see people try to, you know, take this huge hammer and apply it into serverless world all the same, even though when it comes to Lambda, you pay a massive price for using VPCs in terms of how much cold start you experience. My experience tells me that having a Lambda function running inside a VPC can add as much as 10 seconds to your cold start time, which basically rules out any sort of API, any user-facing APIs you have. But with Lambda, you can actually control your functions, the permissions down to the function level. And that's, again, something that I see people struggle with because we don't like to think about all these IAM permissions and stuff. It's difficult. It's laborious. And often,
well, you know, I think the real problem is that no one knows how IAM actually works.
To be fair, though, I'm probably a bad example because I've been using AWS for such a long time and I'm used to the mechanics of IAM and writing the permissions and the policies. But yes, it's much more complicated than people.
It is a little esoteric.
Yes, definitely. And I have seen some tools now coming onto the market, which I think PureSec is one of them, definitely, and a few other ones are all looking at how do we automate this process to both identify what your function needs by doing a static analysis on your code to see how you're interacting with the AWS SDK to see, oh, your function talks to this table. And when you deploy or doing a CI/CD pipeline, you notice that, hey, your function doesn't have the right permissions. It's overly permissive because, again, a lot of people are using just star. Give my function access to everything, which also means now if your function is compromised, the attacker can get your credentials and do everything with that set of temporary credentials you have. So some of these tools are now going to automate a lot of pain that we experience as developers in terms of figuring out what permissions our function actually needs and then trying to automatically generate those templates that we can just put into our deployment framework. And you talked about the deployment framework, deployment being a bit clunky right now. There are quite a lot of different deployment frameworks that takes care of a lot of the sort of plumbing and the complexity under the hood. I don't know if you have tried to provision an API gateway instance using CloudFormation or Terraform. It's horrendous.
It's not exactly simple.
It's so, so complicated because of the way resources are organized in API gateway.
Yep.
But with something like the serverless framework or even with SAM or a number of other frameworks out there, I can just write a human readable URL in one line. Mm-hmm. That translates to, I don't know, maybe 100 lines of CloudFormation template code.
That's awful.
Which is just not something that I want to deal with. So there are frameworks out there that allows you to that ease a lot of the burdens with deployment and some of the observability side of things as well. There's also quite a lot of companies that are focusing on tackling that side of the equation in terms of giving you better traceability. Because one of the things we find with serverless is that people are now building more and more event-driven architectures because it's so easy to do them nowadays. And part of the problem with that is they're a lot harder to trace compared to direct point-to-point API calls. With API calls, I can easily just pass along some correlation ID along the headers, and then a lot of the existing tools like Amazon X-Ray can just kick in and integrates with API Gateway and Lambda already out of the box. But as soon as my event goes over asynchronous event sources like SNS, Kinesis, or SQS, you know, I lose the trace entirely because they don't support sort of asynchronous event sources. But there are companies like Absagon who are now looking at that problem specifically and trying to understand how data flows through the entirety of your system, whether or not it's synchronous through APIs or whether or not it's asynchronous through event streams or task queues or SNS topics that you have. And there's also companies that are focusing on the the sort of cost side of things, understanding the cost of user transactions that spans across this massive web of different functions loosely coupled together through different event sources. Cloud Zero being one of the foremost companies that are focusing on the cost side, the cost story of the sort of serverless architectures. So a lot of the company, there are quite a lot of interesting startups that are focusing on various different aspects of the problems that we've just described so far. And I think in the next, definitely next 6 to 12 months, we're going to see more and more innovation in this space, even beyond what all the things that Amazon's already doing under the hood.
Yeah, that sounds like it would be awesome. This whole area still feels pretty immature to me. Like, I know there's people using it in production, but there's also people that were using Mongo in production and it was dropping data like crazy every day. So, more power to them if they don't like data. But I like stable things. So it sounds like serverless is still maturing. It is ready, but we're still kind of working some of the kinks out. Would that be a fair characterization?
I think that's a fair characterization in terms of the sort of tooling space, because a lot of things are provided by the platform. And as I mentioned before, Amazon is good at meeting the basic needs that you have. So you can probably get by with a lot of tools out of the box, but that also, I guess, slows down some of the sort of commercial tooling support that comes with something like containers, comes with Kubernetes, because again, you only get so much out of the box. So there's a huge opportunity for vendors to jump in very, very quickly. But at the same time, I think those innovations are happening a lot faster than people realize. Maybe one of the problems is just in terms of the education, getting the information about all the different tools that's coming into the space and make people aware of them.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. And what I think a lot of people forget is exactly how old Docker is, because Docker was kind of in the same position of serverless, where it was really cool, but it was still pretty immature. And thinking about when these things came out, and like now that we're seeing Kubernetes, which is maturing that ecosystem further, like that is actually in production. We know the patterns, and we know how all that stuff is being deployed. We know how to manage it. We know the security. Like, it is pretty mature. But how long did it actually take to get there? And looking at it, you have Docker, its initial release was in 2013. That was only 5 years ago, which is blowing my mind. And Kubernetes' initial release was in 2014, 4 years ago. But it's only really been in the past, year or two that Kubernetes has been what we'd call mature. And now we're starting to see this massive uptick of abstraction layers on top of Docker in the form of Kube. At some point, I think we're going to see that with serverless, where it's not just like, oh, we're deploying this Lambda function and calling it a day. I think we're going to see a lot more tooling, a lot more abstraction that brings it all together and makes it so much easier to deal with, especially like at scale.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And just in terms of the days you just mentioned, the first initial announcement on Lambda was 2014. So it's not, so in terms of age, it's not that much younger compared to Docker and the Kubernetes. I guess so where it has differed is that it's a brand new paradigm. Whereas with containers and with Kubernetes, it's a lot easier for you to lift and shift existing workload without having to massive restructure your application to be idiomatic for this new paradigm. With Lambda and with serverless, there is that requirement that in order to be idiomatic, there's a lot of restructuring and rethinking you need to do, because then it's a mind shift change. And that takes a lot longer than just technology change.
Right. Yeah. We're talking about something completely new here. So it's not like, oh, we'll just go implement Lambda overnight and we'll call it a day. Like, we'll just move our whole application over. It's not like when we started putting things in containers. Like, we could actually put a thing in a container, but really all we were doing by lifting and shifting was moving from one server to another, except now it's a smaller server.
Yes.
Like we had the idea of the fat container where you had absolutely everything in a container. Well, that was a bad idea. It was a dumb pattern. And it's going to be the same way with serverless, I think. You can't just lift and shift. It is a brand new architectural pattern. It requires a lot of serious thought.
Yeah, and I think one of the pitfalls that I actually see in terms of the serverless adoption sometimes is that we are so embraced in this whole movement into a new paradigm that sometimes we just forsake all the things we've learned in the past, even though a lot of principles still very much apply. And in fact, a lot of things I've been writing about is basically how do we take previous principles, but apply them and adjust them and make them work in this new paradigm. Because the practices and patterns may have to change because there's, you know, there's some things just don't, doesn't work anymore. But a lot of principles still very much apply. Why do we do structured logging? Why do we do sampling in production? All those things come, the principles still very much apply when it comes to serverless. It's just how we get there is different. And I think that's one of the key things I had to learn the last couple of years is that a lot of things that we learned in the past, just as you know, with databases, a lot of things we learn about databases are still very much there to stay, even if we don't need a specific skill set that DBAs provide for us in the new world of NoSQL databases. In this, you know, when it comes to serverless, I think the same sort of mindset, that sort of, I guess, a leap in from going from looking at, from understanding and looking at practices to understand the principles behind them, why do we do it, and how do we then, can we apply those principles in this new world? That's still super important when it comes to making a successful adoption of serverless in your organization.
That's an absolutely fascinating perspective, because I completely agree. What I absolutely love about it is the principles of site reliability haven't actually changed. The principles of how we run and manage systems hasn't really changed a whole lot in the past 10 years, which is fantastic. Like, that's how it should be. We should always be looking for true principles. It's stuff that kind of pillars of how we behave and how we look at, or look at what we work on. How we do it changes all the time, and it absolutely should, but the principles shouldn't change that much. So, like, absolutely, that's interesting, of trying to apply the principles that we already know to be true, the practices that we know work, and how do we apply it to a new paradigm? And sure, maybe some of them aren't going to apply very well, and we may maybe have to create a new one, which I'm sure there will be coming out of this. But we don't have to start from scratch.
No. What's that saying again? Those who don't know the history are doomed to repeat them.
Right, exactly. We've talked a lot about the failures and the challenges, and you keep mentioning this idea of the business case for serverless. So sell me on it. I want to deploy serverless in my company. I'm just an engineer, but you know, I really like it. So I want to move everything to it. I want to do a new application in it. What should I be thinking about? Like, what? How do I come up with this business case?
I think the most important question there is what does the business care about? And I think every business I know of cares about delivery and speed. As a business, you want to deliver the best possible user experience, and you want to build the right features that your users actually want. But to do that, you need to be able to hit the market quickly and inexpensively, so that you can also then to iterate on those ideas, and that allows you to tell the good ideas from the bad ones, and then you can double down on the good ideas and make them really great. And the more you have to do, the more your engineering team have to do themselves, then by definition, the slower you're going to be able to move. And that's why business should care about serverless, because it frees the engineering teams from having to worry about a whole load of concerns related to how the applications are hosted, and let the real experts, the people that work for AWS, to worry about those undifferentiated heavy lifting. And then that frees the brain power that you actually have, which, by the way, are super expensive, on solving the problems that your users actually care about. No users cares about whether or not your application runs on containers or VMs or serverless, but they do care about when you're going to deliver them. And they do care about building the right features. And that, again, that takes time to, needs you to optimize for time to market and also be able to iterate quickly. A lot of people talk about vendor lock-in as if Amazon's going to one day just worry about Amazon holding the key to your kingdom. But I think the real problem...
That's the last thing I'm worried about.
Yeah, exactly. I think the biggest problem with which you worry about is a competitor who can iterate faster than you, locking you out of the market altogether.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that's why businesses should really care about serverless.
I agree with that. Like that sounds great. The biggest thing that I see with technology is with engineers and their engineering architectural decisions, it seems that a lot of decisions are made essentially on resume-driven development. I've met a lot of engineers who are like, I built this new application in Go because I wanted to learn Go. And I'm like, that's cool. What did the business have to say about that? And it's like, oh, well, I convinced my boss to use Go. I'm like, no, you didn't. Like, your entire shop's in PHP. You basically just said PHP is shit. Like, that was your business case. Instead, like, yes, we should be looking at this from the perspective of how quickly can I get this new product to market? How quickly can I ship this feature? And yeah, there might be some scenarios where switching a language or switching a framework would be useful. But I agree with you that we really should be focused significantly more on time to market and time to value. Like we're here to help our businesses make money, or in my case, to help my business make money. But like for me, I have an application that I'm writing in PHP right now. It's PHP and MySQL, and it's going to be a core facet of my own company. And most engineers would say I'm crazy for writing PHP, but the entire point is that I don't have time to dick around. Like I need to have this out in the market.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree. Those kind of conversations, I've had quite a few of them in the past myself. And also I've heard a lot of similar arguments in terms of why should we use, for example, functional programming. And one argument, I was really involved in the functional programming community for quite a long time, and I'm still a big fan of functional programming, but not for the reason that, it makes your code more concise, more readable. But again, it's about moving up the abstraction ladder so that I have to do less. And it's about getting that leverage to be able to do more with less. And that's I think that's the argument that we should be making more often, more as opposed to, how I like to read my code.
Right. Let's take this from two different perspectives. For the people that are brand new to serverless, what can they do this week or today to learn more about it? And for the people that already have serverless in their infrastructure, what can they do this week to improve their situation?
I think learning by doing is probably always the best way to get to grips on something. So if you're just starting, definitely with serverless, it's so easy to get started and play around with something. And when you're done, just delete everything with CloudFormation, a single button click, or if you're using the right tools, it scans a single command. So definitely go build something. If you got questions or you don't know how the platform behave, then build a proof of concept. Try out yourself. It's super, super simple nowadays. That's how I've learned a lot of things. I've learned about the serverless. It's just by running experiments, coming up with the question, coming up with the hypothesis on how I expect things to do or how the platform to behave, do a proof of concept to answer those questions. And then again, I like to write about things so that I have a record for it afterwards, but also I can share with other people things that I have learned and afterwards as well. And if you are already getting started and you want to take your game to the next level, don't want to be boasting myself, but do check out my blog. I've shared a lot of the things I've learned about running serverless in production and the sort of problems you run into, and addressing a lot of the observability concerns, and also have a video course with Manning as well that you feel free to check out, where we actually build something from scratch and apply a lot of things that I've been talking about for the last year and a half, 2 years, in terms of how do you do all the basic observability things, how to think about security, VPCs and performance and so on. So all of that will be available on the podcast episode notes. And also just let's go out there and talk to other people and learn from them. There's a lot of very knowledgeable people in this space already. People like Ben Cahill from iRobot, people like Paul Johnston and Jeremy Daly, and quite a lot of people who have been very active in sharing their knowledge as well and their experiences. Definitely go out there, find other people who are doing this and trying to learn from them.
That's awesome. So thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find more about you and your work?
You can find me on theburningmonk.com, and that's my blog. I try to write actively, and you can also find me on Twitter as well. I try to share anything that I find interesting, anything I learn, and as well as whenever I write something, also publish there as well. And if you don't want to miss anything, I also have a newsletter you can subscribe to on my blog. So I've tried to write up regular summaries, updates for things I've been doing. And also I'm available for doing some consultancy work if you need some help in your organization, both to get started, but also to tackle specific problems that you have with serverless as well.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And on that note, thanks for listening to the Real World DevOps Podcast. If you want to stay up to date on the latest episodes, you can find us at realworlddevops.com. And on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcast. I'll see you in the next episode.
See you guys.
This has been a Humble Pod production.
Stay humble.